I only like crazy people. So so I'm not going to be talking about Omega. I will talk about that at Wilfrid Laurier tomorrow. And if you want to hear a little bit about my current enthusiasm is what I'm calling optimistically metabiology. It's a field with a lovely name and almost no content at this point. That's on Wednesday at the Quantum Computing Institute. Okay, but I thought it would be fun here, since at this institution, to repeat a talk, to give a version of a talk that you'll see from the talk. It helped to understand the talk. It helps to say that it was first given in Jerusalem a year ago. I'd like to give you a broad sweep of, I'm a mathematician, so who likes physicists? Some mathematicians don't like physicists, you know, who wishes he had been a theoretical physicist at some point. At least I did want to do that. So I want to give you, I'd like to talk about mathematics, and I'd like to give you a sort of a broad overview, a sort of a non-standard view of the of some intellectual history. So it's sort of a perspective of the foundations of mathematics as seen from the perspective of the Middle Ages. This is sort of what this talk is. So here goes. So there is a wonderful book by Umberto Eco called The Search for the Perfect Language. And I recommend it highly to all of you. The Search for the Perfect Language, Umberto Eco likes the Middle Ages. I think he probably wishes we were still there. And this book is talking about a dream that he views as playing a fundamental role in Europeans' intellectual history, which is the search for the perfect language. Now, what is the search for the perfect language? Well, here I can tell you, in your terms, it would be a theory of everything. But the terms in which it was formulated originally is the idea of finding, shall we say, the language of creation, the language before the Tower of Babel, the language that God used in creating the universe, the language whose structure directly expresses the structure of the world, the language in which concepts are expressed in their direct original format. Okay, so you can see this idea is a little bit like the attempt to find a foundational theory of everything. What they really, the notion of this language is that if you knew this language, it would be like having a key to universal knowledge. And if you're a theologian, it would bring you closer to God's, very close to God's thoughts. So it's sort of dangerous. If you're a magician, it would give you magical powers. If you're a linguist, I don't know. One can go on and on. Now, in this very fascinating book, so the idea is sort of to find this language, and if you find it, you're opening a door to absolute knowledge, to certainty, to God, to the ultimate nature of reality, whatever. And there are a lot of interesting chapters in this history. One of them is Raymond Lull, around 1200, a Catalan. And this is a very interesting gentleman who had the idea of mechanically combining all possible concepts to get knowledge. So you would have a wheel with different concepts on it and another wheel with other concepts on it, and you would sort of rotate them to get all possible combinations. And this would be a systematic way to discover the truth. And if you remember Gulliver's Travels, he makes fun in some place in one of his parts of the story, which is not for children but is for adults, of an idea like this. So Raymond Lull, the most interesting figure, as you may have already guessed, and his name was already mentioned, in this book, there's an entire chapter on Leibniz. Now, Leibniz is a wonderful transitional figure here in the search for the perfect knowledge, because Leibniz is universal. So he knows all about all this Kabbalistic. There was Christian Kabbalah, there was Jewish Kabbalah, there were all kinds of hermetic and esoteric doctrines, alchemy. Leibniz knows about all of these things. He knows about ancient philosophy, he knows about scholastic philosophy, and he also knows about what was called mechanical philosophy, which of course was modern science, originally was called mechanical philosophy. And Leibniz sees good in all of this. So he formulates a version of this crazy idea of the search for the perfect language,
which is firmly grounded in this mystical, magical, theological, crazy original idea, but which is fit for consumption by modern contemporary beings. And this is called the Characteristica Universalis. I don't know Latin. Characteristica Universalis, which was a universal language, and which includes a calculo ratiocinator or something. The idea is that you would reduce reasoning to calculation, to computation, because the most certain thing is that 2 plus 5 equals 7. So the idea would be to be able, in other words, the way Leibniz put it in one of his letters, if two people have an intellectual dispute instead of having to duel each other, they could just sit down and say, gentlemen, let us compute and get the correct answer, you know, find out who was right. So this was this idea. And Leibniz is a person who is bored easily, so he flies from field to field like a butterfly, throwing out fundamental ideas and rarely taking the trouble to develop them. One case of this that Leibniz did develop is called the calculus. You've all heard of one case where Leibniz worked this out in beautiful detail. It's Leibniz's version of the calculus. And Leibniz's version of the calculus differs precisely from Newton's version of the calculus because this is what Leibniz was looking for. So Christian Huygens hated the calculus. Christian Huygens taught Leibniz mathematics in Paris at a relatively late age. Most of us mathematicians start very, very young. And Christian Huygens hated Leibniz's calculus because he said it was mechanical, it was brainless. Any fool can just calculate the answer without understanding what he or she is doing. But Huygens preferred, you know, the old synthetic proofs where you would have to be creative, come up with a diagram and, you know, some particular reason for something to be true. Whereas with Leibniz was very concerned with getting the notation, the formalism right, and with a mechanical way to get the answer. Huygens didn't like this, but this was precisely the point. This was precisely what Leibniz was looking for everything. The idea is if you get absolute truth, if you have found the truth, it should mechanically enable you to determine what's going on. You without creativity, this is good, this is not bad. This is precisely also how Leibniz's calculus differed from Newton's. Leibniz saw clearly it was part of his project, you see. Okay, so let me now take a big jump and to David Hilbert about a century. Well, no. Let me stop through an interesting case of this. There is the theory of infinite sets. Cantor's theory of infinite sets. Now, this theory is very interesting to mention also because it's firmly in the Middle Ages and also the inspiration for all of the last century's mathematics. This theory of infinite sets was actually theology. This is mathematical theology. Normally, you don't mention that fact. To be a field of mathematics, the price of admission is you throw out all the philosophy and you just end up with something technical. So all that has been thrown out. But Cantor's goal was to understand God. God is transcendent. The theory of infinite sets has this hierarchy of bigger and bigger infinities, the olives, right? Which I don't know how to write, but you know, you have olive 0, olive 1, olive 2. This is the infinity of integers, real numbers, and you keep going. Each one of these numbers is the set of all subsets of the previous one, and very far out you get mind-boggling infinities like this. Oh, this is the first infinity after olive 0, olive 1, olive 2, olive 3, olive 4. And then you have much further out, then you can start omega plus 1, omega plus 2, omega plus 3. This is a subscript for an olive, which is a cardinality. And much further off, you have olive sub omega squared, olive sub omega to the omega. There's a number called epsilon naught, which is omega to the omega to the omega, which is the smallest solution of x equals omega to the x. And there is a cardinality, which is this, which is pretty big. So this is, you know, God is very far off since God is infinite and transcendent, but we can try to go in his direction. We're never going to get there, because after any cardinality, there's a bigger one, the cardinality of the set of all subsets. And after any infinite sequence of cardinalities that you get, you just take the union of all of that, and you get a bigger cardinality than that infinite sequence. So this thing is inherently open-ended, yes, and contradictory, by the way. Which exponent? No, this goes on forever. Yeah. This epsilon naught is the smallest solution to this. Right. Okay. So there's only one problem. This is absolutely wonderful, breathtaking stuff. You know, it's you have to smoke grass or drink wine to appreciate it fully. The only problem with this, of course, is that it's contradictory. And the problem is very simple. What I already said is a contradiction, because if you take the universal set, the set of everything, and you consider the set of all its subsets, by Cantor's diagonal argument, this should be a bigger cardinality, but how can you have anything bigger than the set of everything, right? And this is the paradox that Russell looked at this and noticed, and he says, well, why do we get this bad result? And if you look at the Cantor's diagonal argument proof that the set of all subsets of everything is bigger than everything, it amounts to considering the set of all sets that are not members of themselves, which can either be a member of themselves or not. Okay, so this is Russell's paradox. But Cantor was aware of this problem, that if you take the universal set and apply this argument, you're in trouble. But, you know, Cantor wasn't bothered by these contradictions because he's doing theology. We're finite, God is infinite. It's paradoxical for a finite being to try to comprehend a transcendent infinite being. So paradoxes are okay. But guess what? The math community is not very happy with a theory which leads to contradictions. However, these ideas are so wonderful that what the math community has done is to forget about all this theology and philosophy, sort of try to sweep it under the rug. There's an expurgated version of this called Zermelo-Franco set theory with the axiom of choice, usually. And this is a formal axiomatic theory which you develop using first-order logic, and it's an expurgated version which is believed to avoid any of these paradoxes. So Bertrand Russell was inspired by all of this to sort of make a critique of, to find a lot of contradictions in a lot of arguments, mathematical arguments, which led to contradictions. So I already told you one, the one that he's most famous for, but he pointed out a number of other ones. Russell turned to mathematics when he became an atheist. First, he was young, and he wanted something. he wanted something beautiful, you know, that had absolute truth. So he turned to mathematics. You know, so you start off as a believer, then you turn to mathematics, and then you turn to drink and suicide. Okay, so anyway, so Russell went around telling people about contradictions. Many of them came from this theory, and he pointed out some other ones. Another problem is the ordinal numbers. There is no biggest cardinal. Another problem is the set of all subsets of everything is too big. Another problem is these ordinal numbers. There's the Borelli-Forti paradox, which is the set of all ordinals is an ordinal that's bigger than all ordinals. These are ordinal numbers. These are the subscripts of ordinal numbers. These are the cardinal numbers. I don't want to get into all of this. I have no time. As usual, right? This is the standard excuse. So David Hilbert, about a century ago, proposes to, after Russell is going around telling people that reason leads to contradiction, David Hilbert proposes a program to put mathematics on a firm foundation. And basically what he proposes is the idea is a modern version of Leibniz's character universalis and calculo ratio similor, and it's called a formal axiomatic theory. He called it, I think, a formal axiomatic system, but the notion of a formal axiomatic theory is, the best way to call it, axiomatic theory. And this was the notion of making mathematical reasoning totally objective, removing all the subjective element. Formal axiomatic theory, so you would have a finite set of axioms that everyone would agree on. You would not use a natural language. You'd use an artificial language, artificial grammar. You would use you'd use mathematical logic, and you'd specify the rules of the game completely. So his idea was, Hilbert's idea was conservative. It was that mathematics gives absolute truth, right? Which is sort of an idea from the Middle Ages, by the way, whenever you mention absolute truth. But mathematicians are enamored of absolute truth. As Gödel said, we're the last holdout from the Middle Ages, in a way, the pure mathematicians. We still believe in this Platonic world of ideas, where everyone else, including philosophers, laugh at this notion nowadays. But pure mathematicians live in this world, okay, that everyone else gave up a long time ago. Okay, so if mathematics give absolute truth, said Hilbert, and all mathematicians somewhere inside believe this, then there ought to exist a finite set of axioms and a set of rules for deduction, for inference, such that all of mathematical truth, you see, if mathematical truth is black or white or purely objective, then there ought to, if you fill in all the steps in a proof and use a notation, an artificial language to avoid ambiguity, you should be able to have a finite set of axioms we can all agree on, and that in principle enable you to deduce all of mathematical truth. And this is just the notion that mathematics provide absolute certainty. What does this mean? What David Hilbert says is the traditional view that mathematics provides absolute certainty, that in the world of Platonic ideas, where pure mathematics exists, everything is black or white, it would mean that there should be a formal axiomatic theory. So that was a very important idea of his. And notice an important consequence of this idea. An important consequence of this idea goes back to the Middle Ages. This perfect language for mathematics, which is what Hilbert was looking for, would in fact give a key to absolute knowledge, because in principle you could mechanically deduce all the theorems from the axioms simply by running through the tree of all possible proofs. You start with the axioms, then you apply, you know, the rules of inference one step, and you get all the theorems that have one-step proofs, and you apply it two times, you get all the theorems that have two-step proofs. And like that, totally mechanically, you would get all of mathematical truth. And Hilbert didn't say this to make mathematics trivial. Of course, in practice, this would take outrageous time to get to interesting results. Plus, all the interesting theorems would be overwhelmed by uninteresting theorems, like 1 plus 1 equals 2, you know, and other things like that. So it would be hard to find the interesting theorems in the, you know, separate the wheat from the chaff or something. But in principle, this would give you all of mathematical truth. And this was not viewed as, it wouldn't actually work this way. But the reason for doing this, oh, and by the way, Hilbert, as part of his program, the idea was you would set up this system, all of mathematicians would agree on it, and you would he proposed something called metamathematics. You would try to give a proof that would convince everyone that this system would avoid all the paradoxes that Bertrand Russell had noticed. Okay, so this was the idea of putting mathematics on a firm foundation and removing all doubts. Okay, so this is Hilbert's idea about a century ago. And it does have this, so metamathematics is studying this from the outside, and notice that you get, this is a door to absolute truth, you know, following the notion for the perfect language. So what happens with this program, this proposal of Hilbert's? Well, there's some good news and there's some bad news. Some of the good news I already mentioned, which is that people worked the closest to what Hilbert asked for is Zermelo-Frankel formal set theory. And it's a beautiful axiomatic theory, and I'll mention some steps along the way. One of the steps along the way is John von Neumann integers. So let me tell you what that is. The idea is the following. Remember that Spinoza has a philosophy in which the world is built out of only one substance. The substance is God. That's all that is. And the Zermelo-Frankel set theory is the same way. Everything is sets, and every set is built out of the empty set. That's all there is the empty set, and bigger sets built up, starting from the empty set. So zero is the empty set. That's the first von Neumann integer. Zero is defined to be this. And in general, n plus 1 is defined to be the set, 0, 1, 2, to n. So if you work this out, n, if you write this out in full, with curly braces, all you have are curly braces. You have set formation with no content, except the empty set. And the notation, the full notation for n, grows exponentially in n, if you write it out, because everything up to that point goes into the next number each time. Okay, but this is a beautiful conceptual scheme. And then you can define rational numbers as pairs of these integers. You can define real numbers as limit sequences of rationals, and you get all of mathematics, starting just with the empty set. So it's a lovely it's a lovely piece of ontology. So here's all of mathematics creation just built out of the empty set. And other people who worked on this are, of course, Frankel and Zermelo, because it's called Zermelo-Frankel set theory. And the sort of notion of what they did was to try to avoid sets that are too big. The universal set is too big. It gets you into trouble. You know, so this is a, okay, so this is a theory that most mathematicians believe enables you to carry out all arguments that normally appear in mathematics, maybe if you don't include category theory, which is very difficult to formalize, I think. Even more paradoxical than set theory, from what I hear. I don't understand much about it. Okay, so that's some of the positive work on Hilbert's program. Now, some of the negative work on Hilbert's program I'd like to tell you about, and you've all heard of it, is, of course, Gödel in 1931 and Turing in 1936. And what they show is that you can't have a perfect language for mathematics. You cannot have a formal axiomatic theory like Hilbert wanted for all of mathematics because of incompleteness, because no such system will include all of mathematical truth. It'll always leave out truths. It will always be incomplete. And this is Gödel's famous incompleteness theorem of 1931. And Turing's original proof is very strange. It's this. It's basically the paradox of this statement is false, which is a paradox, of course, because it can be neither true nor false. If it's false, that it's true. And if it's true that it's false. And that's just a paradox, but what Gödel does is say this statement is unprovable. So if a statement says of itself it's unprovable, there are two possibilities. It's provable or it isn't. If it's provable, we're proving something that's false because it says it's unprovable. So we hope that's not the case. You know, by hypothesis, we'll eliminate that possibility. Okay? Because if we prove things that's false, we have a formal axiomatic theory that we're not interested in because it proves false things. The only other possibility left is that it's unprovable. But if it's unprovable, it's true because it asserts it's unprovable. Therefore, there's a hole. We haven't captured all of mathematical truth in our theory. Okay? So this proof of incompleteness shocks a lot of people, but my personal reaction to it is, okay, it's correct, but I don't understand it. I don't think a better proof of incompleteness, a deeper proof, comes from Turing in 1936. He derives incompleteness from a more fundamental phenomenon, which is uncomputability, the discovery that mathematics is full of stuff that cannot be calculated. You know, things you can define, but you cannot actually calculate, for which there's no algorithm. And in particular, the thing that he discovers is the halting problem, a very simple question. Does a computer program that's self-contained halt, or does it go on forever? And there is no algorithm to answer this in every individual case. Therefore, there is no formal axiomatic theory that enables you to prove in individual cases always what the answer is, because if there were a formal axiomatic theory that is complete for the halting problem, that would give you a mechanical procedure by running through the tree of all possible proofs. You would, until you find a proof that an individual program you're interested in halts, or you find a proof that it doesn't. And that cannot be the case because this is not a computable function. Okay, so this, Turing's insight in 1936 is that incompleteness that Turing found in 1931 of any formal axiomatic theory comes from a deeper phenomenon, which is uncomputability. Okay, but Turing's paper has, yes, good and bad aspects, yes.
No.
Okay. They're not, because Gödel does not formulate the notion of computability or uncomputability. It's not.
So you can derive Gödel's result from?
It's a corollary, and Turing does that in 1936 in his original famous paper. Okay. He makes this observation. Okay, but Turing, there's a negative aspect of his 1936 paper, but there's a positive aspect. You get another proof, a deeper proof of incompleteness, but you get a kind of completeness. You find a perfect language. So there is no perfect language for mathematical reasoning. Gödel showed that in 1931, and Turing showed it in 1936 again. But what Turing showed in 1936 is there are perfect languages, not for mathematical reasoning, but for computation, for algorithms. What Turing discovers in 1936 is that there is completeness. It's called universality in this case, a universal Turing machine or universal programming language. Universal Turing machine or universal programming language, that there are, you know, that this is possible. In other words, what universal means, what a universal programming language or universal Turing machine is, it's a language in which every possible algorithm can be written. So on the one hand, Turing shows us in a deeper way that any language for mathematical reasoning has to be incomplete. But on the other hand, he shows us that languages for computation can be universal, which is just another synonym for completeness. So there are perfect languages for computation, for writing algorithms, even though there are not perfect languages for mathematical reasoning. So this is the positive side. This is the completeness side of Turing's 1936 paper. So now what I've spent most of my professional life on is a subject which derives incompleteness from uncomputability from a deeper phenomenon. I call this algorithmic information theory. And there we deal with algorithmic randomness or algorithmic irreducibility. In this language, there's a negative side, which is the halting probability. The halting probability omega, its bits look like accidental mathematical facts. It looks like they're irreducible mathematical truths. They look contingent. They look accidental. So this is a place in pure mathematics. If you want to know the bits of the halting probability, this is a well-defined mathematical question. In the world of mathematics, all truths are necessary truths. But these look like accidental contingent truths. They look random. It's a place where it's, and this is irreducible complexity. So this is a maximal case of uncomputability. This is a place in pure mathematics where there's absolutely no structure at all. You can, in some cases, know a few of the first bits.
Few cases, one case.
No? Well, no, there is not one case. There are actually an infinite number of halting probabilities depending on your choice of programming language. Once you fix a language, then you ask what is the probability that a program generated by coin tossing halts. And that gives you a different halting probability. The numerical value can be different if the paradoxical properties are the same. Okay, so there are cases for which you can get a few of the first bits. For example, if the first bits are all ones in binary or nines in decimal, you can know those. So you can get a finite number of bits, perhaps, of the numerical value. But if you have an n-bit mathematical theory, you can't get more than n bits, is sort of the general result. It's irreducible, logically and computational irreducible information, those bits. It's a perfect simulation within pure math world truths are necessary of essentially a contingent accidental maximum entropy truths. Okay? So this is the bad news. This is the bad side. But just like Turing's 1936 work, there is this sort of maximal uncomputability here, which is a place where mathematical truth has absolutely no structure. It's maximum entropy. It looks totally unstructured in an information theoretic sense. But there's also a good news, the same as in Turing's case. What this theory does, this theory where you look at program size complexity, the theory where omega is, in which omega is the crown jewel, goes a little further than Turing and picks out from Turing machine's universal languages, maximally expressive programming languages. Because those are the ones you have to use to develop this theory where you get to omega. So algorithmic information theory has this notion of the most concise expressive languages in which programs are more compact. And deals with a complexity concept, which is the size of the smallest program to calculate something. And so we have a better notion. So the perfect languages that Turing found, universal programming languages, we now concentrate on a subset, which are the ones which give the most concise programs. These are the most expressive languages, okay, where the programs can be simpler. Now, let me tell you, this idea is a technical way of expressing it in modern terms. Let me put this in medieval terminology. You can view a way of saying what these languages are like is what the notion of program size complexity, what we call that now, I mean, there are many names for it, descriptive complexity, Kolmogorov complexity, you know, whatever, algorithmic information content. In medieval terms, what we're asking is how many yes-no decisions did God have to make to create something? Which obviously is a sort of a basic question to ask, right? If you view that God is calculating the universe, okay? So it can be considered in I'm giving you a medieval perspective on these modern developments always, okay? In other words, theology is the theoretical physics of the Middle Ages, you know. So So anyway, so so let me. Looks like I have a lot of spare time. Okay, so let me. Since I've been racing through this, maybe I should put a little bit more meat on some of this. The particular notion of a universal Turing machine is this idea, this very basic idea, is flexible software, is flexible hardware, which we call software. This is this fundamental idea. Turing, in a way, in 1936, creates the computer industry, computer technology. You know, that's a tremendous benefit of a paper that mathematically, in a way, is very negative, it sounds at first. It talks about things that cannot be known, things that cannot be calculated, things that cannot be proved. But on the other hand, there's a very positive side of it. I said in theoretical terms that programming languages can be universal, even though formal axiomatic theories cannot be complete. Okay, so you get this technology. So there's this notion of a flexible machine, or this notion of software, which emerges in this paper, and von Neumann would point that out. That's how I heard about this the first time as a student. Now, algorithmic information theory, where you talk about program size complexity and the size of the smallest program, how many decisions, yes, no decisions does God have to make to calculate something or create something, picks out a particular class of universal Turing machines, and let me write down the key fact. Okay, here we have a arbitrary computer. Pick any computer, universal Turing machine to mathematicians, right? Or you pick a programming language, and here's the program that you give it, this computer. And this means, this function, C of P, means the result of giving the program P to the computer C. Okay, so here's a particular computer. Now, what are the universal computers like that you use to define program size complexity and talk about omega? Well, they have this property. A universal computer has the property that for any other computer and its program, your universal computer will calculate the same result if you give it the original program concatenated to a prefix, which depends only on the computer that you want to simulate, which says what computer do you simulate. And this is the concatenation of two pieces of information. This is a binary string, this is a binary string. You take the original program, and all you have to do is put in front of it a fixed prefix which tells you what computer to simulate, which means that these programs are only a fixed number of bits larger than the programs for any individual machine. These are the universal Turing machines that you use in this theory of program size complexity. These are the most expressive languages. These are the languages with maximum expressive power. These are the languages in which the programs are as concise as possible. So this is how you define this. Yes?
I had a Turing machine that didn't have that property. How could it still be universal?
Well, the original concept of universality of Turing just says that, you're given in some way the program for another computer, plus told which computer to it's for, and that it's a little weaker, because it might be that the way that this information is given to universal machine is verbose rather than compact. So what this is saying is that this is a particularly efficient way to be universal. The original notion of universality in Turing was not this demanding. It just said a universal machine is one that can simulate any other machine, and the way Turing did it was his universal machine is given, remember the state transition table that defines the universal Turing machine? Okay, so you're just given all that information you give the universal machine on the tape all the state transition function that defines another Turing machine, a specific Turing machine, plus you give it the input, and then the universal machine simulates what that particular Turing machine would do with that input tape. But the way you give that information can be verbose. I mean, you're giving it a lot of pairs which say, you're giving it a function which says, given the state and what it sees on the tape in one place, what to do and what state to go to next. And that information can be given in a very verbose way. What you're pointing out here is that if you with a little care, you can just add, you can just add the, it just takes a fixed number of bits. You can just add a fixed number of bits to the program. This is not completely trivial. Let me tell you why. When you concatenate these two into another bit string, you have to say where the prefix ends and the program begins. You have to know how to split this in two. In Turing's original formulation, it's done by in a very wasteful way. So it's a question of punctuation. How do you give a bit string that? How do you do this in a way where this is a fixed number of bits, but it's self-delimiting? You have to know where this prefix ends and the program to simulate begins. And there are various ways to do it. A very simple one is just to have the prefix be a sequence of zeros followed by a one. And the number of zeros, that's very wasteful prefix. Another way to take this information, if you think the information that this is an interpreter for the other programming language, really. Universal language is one that you give it an interpreter plus the program for the input for the other program. And the universal machine will carry the interpreter. The interpreter, if you think of this as a string of bits, for example, instead of doing this, you can just double each bit. 0 goes to 0, 0. 1 goes to 1, 1. And then you put a pair of unequal bits as punctuation at the end.
0, 0, 0.
Yes. Thank you, Lenny. So this is a way to have a self-delimiting prefix that when you concatenate it with the binary data, you can. But this doubles the size. This increases its size exponentially. This doubles the size. And there are much more efficient ways. Essentially, all you need to do in general is to add a logarithmic term, you know, to indicate how many bits there are. But it's sort of like Russian dolls, because if you're going to put in front of this a prefix which says how many bits there are, that has to be self-delimiting too. So anyway, there are some technical details. Anyway, this is the key idea in algorithmic information theory. The 1960s version that, as I said, Solomonov, Kolmogorov, and I independently proposed is not the right approach. You want, in fact, the whole program to be self-delimiting, not just this prefix. You want the whole thing to be self-delimiting to get the right theory. And in other words, the basic difference between the 1960s version of AIT and the 1970s version of AIT, algorithmic information, program size complexity, is that here an n-bit string in general will need an n-bit program if it's irreducible. Most strings are algorithmically irreducible. Most n-bit strings need an n-bit program. Those are the ones that have no pattern. Most strings have no pattern or structure. There aren't enough short programs to go around. Most n-bit objects need an n-bit program because there aren't enough smaller programs. But in 1970s, it looks like a step backwards. It's sort of n plus log 2 n bits because you want to make the programs self-delimiting. Actually, it's n plus the size of the smallest program, self-delimiting program to calculate n. That's exactly what that term is. Most n-bit objects, strings in the 1970s version, the smallest program for them is n bits plus the size of the smallest program to calculate n, which is roughly log of 2 of n. But again, it's sort of n plus log base 2 of n plus log base 2 of n plus, you know. Okay, so that's sort of the paradoxical aspect of this. But this version of algorithmic information theory, which is just taking the idea from the prefix and applying it to the whole program, actually is an even better algorithmic information theory. It has two stages. The first stage is to say that these are the most perfect languages. You take from the universal programming languages the ones that have this property, but then you add this self-delimiting requirement, and when you do that, you get results such as subadditivity of program size complexity, which are not the case if you don't do this. You cannot define the halting probability. If you allow all n-bit strings to be programs, you cannot define in a natural way the probability that a program will halt, because the natural way, okay, let me just, this is the key technical point in program size complexity. I'd like to define a halting probability, right? The probability of the program chosen at random will halt. The normal way of thinking about programs is there are 2 to the n n-bit programs, right? But the natural way to define the halting probability is as the sum of 2 to the minus the size in bits of each program p that halts. So a k bit, if p has k bits and halts, it contributes 1 over 2 to the k to the halting probability. The only problem with this is that it diverges, because for any fixed size k, there are roughly of the order of 2 to the k programs at Hall. So if you sum over all possible sizes, this is not a normed measure. This diverges to infinity. The total probability here is infinite, which is no good. So to be able to define a halting probability that doesn't give you infinity, that is between 0 and 1, you have to make sure that the total probability of all programs sums to less than or equal to 1. And the way to do that is the same as this idea of the prefix here, which is as you read the program, let me put it in anthropomorphic terms. As the universal machine reads the program bit by bit, it has to be able to decide by itself where the program ends. That's a way to say that no extension of a valid program is a valid program. And then this sum, it's called the Kraft inequality in Shannon information theory. Then this sum, the set of all possible programs is, the technical term is a prefix-free set, and there's some. But intuitively, it's just the idea that as you read the program bit by bit, you realize where to stop. And you, in other words, the original algorithmic information theory, program size complexity of the 1960s, essentially was using an alphabet of 3 symbols, 0, 1, and blank. And the blank said where a program ends. But that's a symbol that you're wasting because you use it very little. As you all know, if you have a 3-symbol alphabet, the right way to use it is to use each symbol roughly 1/3 of the time. So if you really use only zeros and ones, then you have to have a force the Turing machine to decide by itself. You don't put a thing indicating a blank end marker at the end of the program saying this is the end of the program. But the advantage, so programs go from n bits long in general. For a program to calculate an n-bit string goes from having n bits to having roughly n plus log 2 n bits, because you've got to indicate in the program how big it is. But on the other hand, if you have two programs concatenated, if you can combine subroutines. So if you have a program, the smallest program to calculate x and the smallest program to calculate y, you can just concatenate these two subroutines and you can just break them apart. You just start running your universal machine to calculate the first object, and then you just run it again, and you calculate the second object. So in other words, program size complexity is subadditive because you can just take subroutines and concatenate them to make a bigger program. So these are the languages up to this point that program size complexity, this theory, has discriminated as the ideal most perfect languages. There were 2 stages. Okay, for computation, for expressing calculations, not for expressing. So these are universal languages that are most expressive, which we already did in 1960s and in 1970s, that have other desirable properties. And if you don't do this, you can't define the halting probability, for example. So maybe I should sort of summarize this saga. So this search for the perfect language has some negative conclusions and some positive conclusions. Now, so Hilbert wanted to find a perfect language giving all of mathematical knowledge, you know, a formal axiomatic theory for all of mathematics. You know, this was a theory of everything for the world of pure math. And this cannot succeed because we know that every formal axiomatic theory is incomplete, as shown by Gödel, by Turing, and by the halting probability omega. So instead of finding a perfect language, a perfect formal axiomatic theory, we found incompleteness, uncomputability, and even algorithmic irreducibility or algorithmic randomness. Okay, so that's the negative side of this, but that's sort of fascinating from an epistemological point of view. We found limits to what we can know through reason. Now, interestingly enough, the mathematic community couldn't care less. They still want absolute truth. And if you want a proof, and they still believe in it, and that mathematics gives it. So if you go to the December 2008 issue of the Notices of the American Mathematical Society, you will see a special issue devoted to formal proof. And the engineering technology has been developed to the point where they can run real mathematics through proof checkers and get them checked. And these people now, the extremists are saying that in the future, all mathematics has to be done in...
It's a form of computation.
Why is the definition of mathematics broader than what you can do by what you call computation?
Reasoning is different from a language for proving things is different from a language for expressing algorithms. They're 2 different things. because you're proving things.
Language when they're talking about mechanical languages.
Yeah, a programming language. Yeah. A programming languages can be universal and even maximally precise and have other nice properties. But so there are perfect languages for programming, for algorithms, but there are no perfect universal complete languages for mathematical proofs, for reasoning. Computation, yes, reasoning, no, because of incompleteness.
Reasoning is a human thing.
What do you mean reasoning is a human thing? Reasoning is the closest absolute truth we get, which is why Plato loved mathematics. What?
I don't think you believe that either.
I do on Sunday. That's why he became a pure mathematician, right? This is the only place where absolute truth is left. So in fact, there's tremendous now development, now engineering work on formal proofs. And the idea is now that they have formal systems with proof checkers where you can take real mathematical results and run them through. For example, the proof of the four-color conjecture has been written out as a formal proof that was run through a proof checker. Would you believe this? And the statement of these extremists is that in the future, all mathematics should be done in a formal system. The referee will, you have to have it checked. It has to be, that's the referee, but there's still a human referee necessary to say if the paper is worth publishing. At that point, we know at least that the proofs are correct. And they want a repository of all mathematical knowledge, which will be a database of checked theorems. It's a large community, and go to the December 2008 issue of the AMS notices, and I gave you there the URL for this talk, and there you will find a link. You'll find an outline of this talk with a link to the AMS notices December 2008 issue, which is online. So this is a serious community of mathematicians, and the AMS notices gave a special issue to this, which means that absolute truth is still popular in pure mathematics.
I'm still not getting it. I don't understand why those techniques, that technology, is not a special case of universal computation.
Well, it is, because that technology is, the human being has to provide a formal proof, that the proof checker will agree is correct. Well, the proof checker
the
is...
The proof checker only checks, it can't produce...
Exactly.
But you could still use that recombining method on the axioms to arbitrarily produce proofs, though. It's just that it would usually give you results that nobody cares about.
Well, also the time is exponential to prove. The time grows exponentially. Yeah. It's only in theory, in principle.
Yeah.
Only in the sense of the Middle Ages would be happy with. Yes, another question? I have more to say, though, but let me take some questions.
I've seen my friend do this. He writes out a skeleton of proof, and then he says, if you can prove this and this, then the whole thing works. And then the proof checker looks for proofs of that. And that actually works in great many cases.
Yeah.
So it's
if it doesn't get it, it says, I don't see right. it. Then you add a little more. And until the proof checker is getting better and better.
It can either tell you that there is a proof or that it couldn't find one. It can't tell you whether it's possible. But
you can look at it almost as a proof assistant.
Are you disparaging this attempt?
Because I'm not disparaging this attempt. I'm saying there's a wonderful intellectual tension between Gödel's 1931 result, which is so famous and discussed so often, and the fact that in a way people don't want to believe it, and they still want to go ahead and carry out Hilbert's program, just as if Gödel and Turing had never happened. You see, I think this is very interesting. Yes.
Well,
I have more to say, though. Oh, sorry. Can I just, before opening this to general discussion, this was the negative conclusions of this saga. I want to tell you the positive conclusions. There are perfect languages for computing, not for reasoning, right? They're computer programming languages. And we have universal Turing machines and universal programming languages. You say universal rather than complete, but these are completeness results. And we even have the most expressive concise languages that program size complexity has picked out and shown are particularly good. So there is a positive spin-off, and in particular, since I've worked on program size complexity, you know, I view that as a contribution because it's a measure of conceptual complexity of ideas. You know, I said it from the perspective of the Middle Ages, it's how many yes-no decisions God has to make to create something, if you view God as a computer programmer. Right. Okay, from the theoretical side, this quest
in some ways was disappointing due to Gödel incompleteness. There is no formal axiomatic theory. There is no theory of everything for pure math. Provably, there is no theory of everything for pure math. In fact, if you look at the bits of the Hawking probability, you can show that pure mathematics has infinite complexity. And in this sense, is more like biology, the domain of the complex, and like theoretical physics, where we hope there's a simple, elegant theory of everything. Okay, so this is the negative side, unless you're a biologist. The positive side, though, is we get this marvelous programming technology. You know, so this dream, the search for absolute knowledge, in a way ended in the guts and the bowels of a computer, or ended in a golem. So in fact, let me put this, what actually happened, in terms of the Middle Ages. You know, this notion was to get magic godlike powers, the search for the perfect language, which for that reason. Because access for absolute truth is satisfying, but this is power also. It gives you the ability to do things. And let's bring somebody from the year 1200 here and show them a PC. You have this dead machine, right? It's a machine, it's a physical object. And you put software in it, and all of a sudden it comes to life. So from the perspective of the Middle Ages, I would say that, in fact, the perfect languages we have found have given us some magic godlike powers, which is that we can breathe life into not all, but some inanimate matter. And so because you can sort of, there's sort of this analogy that hardware is sort of like the body and software is sort of like the soul. And when you put software into a PC, this is an inanimate object that comes to life and has virtual worlds on it. And would so from the perspective of somebody from the year 1200, the search for the perfect language in fact has worked and has given us some magic godlike powers, except we take them for granted. Thanks very much. Whatever, this is an informal bunch, right? I don't know. Or maybe I'm a little dazed. Maybe you want to pick out the, while I try to recover here.
Let me ask you a sort of bottom line question, and I think it's a matter of opinion, I think. But I'm just wondering what your opinion is. So if an object exists, let's say a number, that it can't be computed.
A specific number that can't be computed.
It could be too big. Does it exist if it can't be computed?
Let's talk about real numbers.
For you personally.
Let's talk about real numbers.
Yeah, right.
There's this notion that Turing, 1936, a real number is computable if there's an algorithm for calculating it digit by digit, better approximations. Right. And it turns out, guess what? With probability one, a real number is uncomputable. Right? Turing doesn't say that in his result. So the point is, so what does this mean? To me, we're going to get into the bottom line, I have a digital philosophy. I think the world is built out of information. I think if the world is discrete, and I don't really believe in uncomputable objects. So omega, the Hawking probability, is my...
You answered the question.
Right. Is sort of a Pyrrhic victory.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't exist.
That's what I was asking.
Good question, Mario.
Okay. So, are there any examples, and can there be any concrete examples of these maximally concise languages?
Well, sure. There are an infinite number of possibilities. Okay. You're saying, do any of the languages that people actually use have this property? The answer is no, because in fact, you don't want your programs to be maximally concise. APL2 was a language like this. The programs are extremely cryptic. You want the programs to be comprehensible and modifiable and good for humans to work with. However, I have actually taken the trouble in one of my books, which I just contributed to your library here. I have a series of books where I use Lisp I actually invent a usable programming language which has all these good properties. So and in fact I have a Java applet for it on my website. So and these books are full of examples of actually running programs. And so in fact I have worked out, I thought it was sort of ridiculous to prove theorems about this and not actually you know, exhibit such a language and make it usable.
Is Lisp that language?
No, but it's I make a dialect of Lisp in which in one line I can define the universal Turing machine. You see, so what it sort of is you know, Lisp is sort of a high level, low level language, high level machine language in a way. So the way this programming language works is a program is a big bit string, and the prefix is a Lisp expression, a Lisp S expression. So this is a high level, converted to binary, so you take each character and make it in 8 bits. And by the way, Lisp expressions, you know, are self-delimiting because the parentheses have to balance. As soon as the parentheses balance, it's finished, right? So and what you need, the key, you have to add a few things to Lisp to make this all work out. And the key thing you add is read next bit or read next X expression from the program. And this has got to fail if you run off the end of the program. It cannot tell you end of file or end of data, because that would give you the old 1960s version of program size complexity. So you have to force the program to be written in such a way that you don't run off the end of the program. And so all this is worked out with lots of examples in three Springer Verlag volumes I have called The Limits of Mathematics, The Unknowable, and Exploring Randomness. And on my website, you actually have a Java applet. There's also a Mathematica version of this interpreter. So, and it's actually can be used practically. So what you do is you write a program in Lisp, and then you just, there's a primitive in my version of Lisp that converts this to a bit string, and you just concatenate it to the rest of the program, and then you can actually run these programs and look at their size. And so what I tried to do was make a concrete version of this theory. In other words, pick a universal Turing machine to base this theory on, a single one. So you're, in effect, I'm picking a particular value of the halting probability by picking the particular language. And I wanted the language to be a language that's usable. You know, since we have enough software technology, that was my profession at IBM, was doing practical software work. So I know how to do that. So you know, computability theory and program size complexity, it's sort of ridiculous that computability theory is the only course in a computer science department where you don't actually write and run programs. You know, so I thought I should fix that. So I did that in some of my books.
But are now in your library.
So I guess this might come up momentarily at lunch, but I'm wondering, is there any way, or have you thought at all about dealing with how long these programs take to run? I mean, presumably, having concise programs is a desirable property of the universal machine, and maybe having ones that run efficiently is desirable.
Yeah, I don't worry about it. Most people in theoretical computer science who work on complexity care about runtime. And I don't. I only care about information complexity. And there's a reason. The reason is that you get a more elegant theory if you forget about runtime. So let me, this is an old thing. Thermodynamics, you run a heat engine, you run a heat engine very slowly, right? So it'll be reversible. So it's a sort of the same thing. These information arguments, when you don't care about the runtime, as long as it's finite, give you very elegant results. So, you know, the way pure mathematics works is pure mathematics, Picasso, art is a lie that helps us to see the truth, right? In my bad French, how was it? Ilias told me how you say it in the original French, Picasso said it. L'art est un mensonge qui nous aide à connaître la vérité. Okay, so theories are lies that help us to see the truth. You know, so algorithm information theory is a model of computation which only it gives you nice theorems because it only looks at the size of the programs, not at the runtime. It just has to be finite. Okay. So, but there are people who worry about runtime and who have tried to combine program size with runtime. And I don't know what the status of all of this is. At one time, it was a hot subject.
Yeah,
I think it didn't. I think at the moment, it sort of disappeared as a research area. Oh, you're in charge.
So this sort of FAS system where you have a set of axioms that you then sort of crank to get proofs,
Hilbert.
Right, that doesn't give you everything, but it does sort of relate directly to computability, right?
Well, the theorems are a computable function of the axioms.
Yeah. That's sort of what I mean, right? But what I mean is...
There's a mechanical procedure for getting all of truth.
Right, but if,
from your axioms,
yeah.
All of the consequences of the axioms from
what I mean is, sort of what I'm thinking of is, if you have an uncomputable number, or a minimally
real number, all positive integers are computable, trivial.
Okay. Or if you have sort of one of these real numbers that you can't compute with a program less, you know, with less information than the number itself.
Okay, that's an algorithmically irreducible real number, like the Holder probability omega. Yeah.
Right, yes.
What about?
Are there mathematical truths that have a similar property to that in terms of, you know, that sort of axiom grinding?
I can't understand the question, but...
I'm sorry.
No, but let me give you a version. I mean, are there facts in mathematics where you get algorithmically irreducible truths, an infinite sequence of sort of unstructured, maximally unstructured truths out?
Yeah.
And the answer is yes. You can dress up. I mean, there are a lot of technology was developed after Turing's 1936 paper on the unsolvability of the Halting problem. And what they do is they find that there are many mathematical questions in sort of real mathematics that are equivalent to the Halting problem. Therefore, there's no algorithm to solve them. You know, for example, the word problem for semigroups, right, there is algorithmically undesolvable. So the Hilbertstein's problem is equivalent to the Halting problem. There is no algorithm to decide if a Diophantine equation has or doesn't have solutions in positive integers. If you could do that, you could solve the Turing-Halting problem. So I can take that same technology and sort of apply it to the bits of the Halting probability. So, for example, there is a Diophantine equation with lots of variables with a parameter, and let's say you fix the value of the parameter and you ask, does this equation have a finite or infinite number of whole number solutions? And I can make the Diophantine equation be such that the number of solutions will be finite or infinite as I vary this parameter, precisely giving me the bits of the Halting probability omega. So this was my article in 1988 in Scientific American called Randomness and Arithmetic was about this. I actually, for the fun of it, since I'm a computer programmer, as well as a theoretician, I actually produced the Diophantine equation. It was 200 pages long, and it had 20,000 variables and one parameter, okay? And that was what that Scientific American article was about, and that's what my 1987 Cambridge University Press monograph, Algorithmic Information Theory, is about, which is now in your library. You'll find pages which are five pages from the beginning of this Diophantine equation, which gives you the bits of omega in elementary number theory. And you can dress up other questions that way. There are a number of... So, I mean, from this point of view, it would look like pure mathematics shouldn't work. You know, like there is this point of view would suggest that the oceans of knowability are like small islands in a sea of unknowability. These results are too negative, is what I'm saying. All this work is too pessimistic. In fact, pure mathematics is doing very well. And I think at this point, the burden of proof or the onus of whatever is on the other shoe. I think now it would be interesting to have a meta-mathematical theory saying how come mathematics, in fact, works so well in spite of all these very negative results, which would suggest that pure mathematics was not a viable enterprise, and it's on the contrary. So, yeah. Gödel himself has a few unpublished essays, which were then published after his death in his collected papers, where he talks about this. And the problem is, he can argue on philosophical grounds that maybe pure mathematics can get around, mathematicians can get around his incompleteness theorem by direct intuition of the Platonic world of ideas, for example. But, you know, this is not as convincing as his incompleteness theorem where he can prove a philosophical statement. You know, it'd be nice to give a proof that mathematics can get around the incompleteness theorem. It can't be a constructive proof because then you would have a theory of everything. So it'd have to be a non-constructive proof.
Unpublishable result. Maybe one more question. Rob?
So, quick
comment before the question. You're talking about the role of theology in the foundations of mathematics. I discovered recently that theology also played a role in the foundations of quantum theory. Is one of the most important results in foundations of quantum theory is the Cauchy-Specker theorem. And Ernst Specker was actually thinking in the 60s about whether God would be able to know the outcomes of any quantum measurement before he developed that. So I just thought it might be interesting. The question is, I've read somewhere that you could take the lesson of Gödel's theorem to be that mathematics should be done in a style that's more like science. Science, we look at...
I've been arguing that for 30 years. Nobody's listening, but why do you think I'm here at a physics group? Mathematicians don't like me.
I was going to ask, do you agree with that? And the answer is yes.
Yeah, I've been proposing that in print since 1974.
It contradicts what you said 2 minutes ago.
It's possible, Lenny. No? I'm human, I contradict myself.
You said these things are too negative.
But don't ask him to prove his own consistency.
Well, look, yeah, my tentative conclusion from all of this, which of course is just my personal opinion, there's a phrase that Lakatos came up with, quasi-empirical view of mathematics, that term, quasi-empirical. Another term that's good to think of is experimental mathematics. And here in Canada, you used to have Jonathan Borwein promoting experimental mathematics. I'm a little more extreme in my position. I think one possible way around incompleteness, I don't think incompleteness is an obstacle to progress in mathematics. It certainly isn't in practice, because this century has been tremendous mathematical progress. But if it bothers you, I think that the answer, one of the possible answers, is that pure mathematics has to be done. It's not theoretical physics, but maybe it's more like theoretical physics than pure mathematicians would like to admit. In other words, the normal notion in mathematics is that an axiom has to be a self-evident truth. And in physics, axioms are not self-evident, right? I mean, the Schrodinger equation is not self-evident, Einstein's field equations are not self-evident. They're pragmatically justified. They work. They help us recognize a large body of data. So I think I've been promoting for 30 years the idea, the tentative conclusion that maybe pure mathematics should be pursued quasi-empirically, which is if you can find a proof, fine. But if not, if there is some unproved assertion, like, say, P not equals to NP, or the Riemann hypothesis, that helps you understand a lot of mathematical questions, we should go ahead like a physicist would. You know, we can't prove it, but it helps us to, organize our mathematical experience. So a physicist would say, for now, it's a working principle, right? In the future, I may find something better, but so I've been promoting this as a way mathematicians should proceed since 1975, and along the way, strangely enough, they've done it in several cases. The three main cases, I mentioned one earlier, is P not equal to NP. Nobody can prove it, but everybody in complexity theory sort of assumes it, right? So this is like a new axiom. They're behaving like mathematics, as if mathematics were an empirical science. They're behaving like a physicist would behave. Another question is the Riemann hypothesis, sort of an example, although some number theorists told me that unfortunately there are many versions of the Riemann hypothesis, so this is not such a good example. There isn't just one version, which is in fact what everybody believes in and help. The Riemann hypothesis, various versions of it, help you organize a lot of stuff. If never found something that contradicts it, okay, Riemann hypothesis. Then there's an example which is in cryptography, in theory of computer science and cryptography. The people assume that factorization is hard, right? Nobody can prove it, but it's sort of it's like a new possibility, it's behaving like a physicist would. The most interesting example is also in the Notices of the American Society, and it is in Zermelo-Frankel set theory, and it's a new axiom that community has decided to add, and it's called projective determinacy. And there are two wonderful articles on this by Wooden, but Wooden has published in the Notices of the American Mathematical Society, I don't have the exact reference, it was several years ago. What's happened in set theory is that there's a lot of stuff that people believe in but can't prove. And one of them is called Cantor's Continuum Hypothesis, which Gödel has an essay on. And people have been looking for new axioms to add to Zermelo-Frankel set theory. And they've come up with one. Projective determinacy is highly non-obvious. It only took 30 years for some of the smartest mathematicians, pure mathematicians on Earth, to agree that it's obvious that this should be added as a new axiom. And because if you do, if it turned out to be equivalent to a lot of things that people believe in that they couldn't prove. And so now the consensus in the community is that this should be added. So it's a highly non-self-evident, I submit that this is a highly non-self-evident axiom, that set theorists, abstract set theorists, are adding a set theory because it helps them to organize and prove a lot of stuff that they'd like to prove to organize their set theoretic world. Incidentally enough, the joke is that it still doesn't enable you to settle Cantor's continuum hypothesis, which was the original purpose for all of this. So I think here, this is the purest of the pure, right? There is nothing purer than abstract set theory. You know, in a way, this is the fundamental ontology, essence, bedrock of pure mathematics. But these people are behaving like physicists, you know, like we would if I... if you're nice enough to let me consider myself briefly to be a physicist, sort of. So I think that this is a good example of a case where pure mathematicians who, you know, are the purest of the pure are behaving like as if mathematics were quasi-empirical, as a little bit as if it were physics. So, in other words, Arnold put it really like this. He said, pure mathematics is like physics, except the experiments are cheaper. I think that's a very good thing. You just run it on a computer.
You know? But if I get it right, it's absolutely guaranteed that this won't be enough, and there'll have to be another one, and then there'll have to be another one, and then there'll have to be another one.
Well, isn't that good? I mean,
that's fine.
I mean, what are our bank children going to work on?
And I think to say this, but the same applies to questions, and I think we should thank the speaker again. It's always, you don't want to leave, you don't have to.